every week I do a lot of searching through the Buddha's teachings, the thousands and thousands of suttas, looking for stuff that not only I haven't been exposed to, even after 25 years of Buddhist study and 10 years exclusively in the Pali Canon, there's so much stuff in there, and I'm always looking for stuff not only for my own practice, but stuff to share with you. And this week I stumbled across a sutta I had never read before, and I gave it a good look through, and then I went to do my normal listening to my teacher, who's got his Dharma lessons and teachings on the web, and I do a lot of listening to Dharma talks throughout the week. And the talk he gave was on this exact same sutta, so it was a weird message in there for me. I'm not one of those people who believe that there's anything metaphysical about stuff like that. It's just stuff that I notice, and it means that it's something that my mind needs to take into account. So I thought I'd share this teaching with you, and hopefully it will be of some use. It's already been something I've been reflecting on quite a bit, and I think it's a pretty interesting talk that the Buddha gave. There's a famous analogy that Ajahn Lee, I believe, gave, the monk, that if you were guiding somebody down a mountain path, and you weren't allowed to, for some reason, I can't imagine why, but you weren't allowed to actually grab hold of them, you just had to give them verbal directions. It's an analogy, work with me. But they're blindfolded and they're going down a mountain path, so the only thing you can do is give them verbal directions. You'd say, if they were veering too far to the right, you'd say, go left. And if they were veering too far to the left, nearing a cliff's edge, you'd say, go right. You'd probably also say, go slow, you know. The idea, of course, is that we're looking for balance. And a lot of people will read or open up a teaching of the Buddha, and the Buddha will say in that teaching, go left. And they'll think, wow, the Buddha's all about going left all the time. Or they'll read a teaching and the Buddha will talk about going to the right, moving your practice in a certain direction. They'll think, oh, well, the Buddha's all about going to the right. But actually, the Buddha was all about balance. And he taught different spiritual tools to balance out. In other words, in a lot of Western practices, we have a tendency to take one teaching and run with it all the time, thinking, oh, I'm really good at this. I'm really good at the meditation. I don't really like the studying too much, and the precepts, they're okay. But I'm really good at the meditation, so I'm just going to do that. I'm just going to run with that. Or I'm really good at this studying part, but I don't really like the going on, you know, meditation, extended meditation, or whatever. We have our preferences. And a core part of this teaching is about looking at what our preferences are in our lives and seeing where there's how they lead to how the things we like and the things we gravitate towards can often lead to us being out of balance. And we might find ease and comfort in one area, and then we gravitate towards there, and then we lose our ability to do something else. I know that, you know, in successful relationships, there's a tendency for one person to be better at one thing and another person to be better at something else, and then over a number of years, you might lose the... I just got this, and I don't know how to...
turn...
Nice, thank you. The idea of this teaching is to turn and look at ourselves and see where we've been moving towards, often sometimes a little bit unskillfully, and see where the areas in life we could actually focus a little bit more to gain some balance, to gain a greater sense of a wider range of spiritual and skillful behaviors. So the Buddha, in this teaching, listed seven, and I'm going to go through them, seven things to reflect on, and he called this the Dhammana Sutta, which means the, basically it means the behaviors of a skillful person, or the notable acts, problematic ego, and then I'm going to tap into this cosmic self and everything's going to be really easy and I'm not going to have to really do that much. Well, the Buddha actually said, no, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of cultivating skillful actions. It's not just like you get to drop your ego and everything will magically go right. There's actually a lot more to it than that. So it's important not to just rest in the sort of preconceived, the things that we've heard by word of mouth. It's important to familiarize ourselves by going and hearing teachers, people who've studied a spiritual path for a while, and really trying to get beyond what we want it to be and really hear what's there. Now, a lot of us come to Buddhism and we really have had a lot of understandable dislike for religious fundamentalism. And that's quite understandable. And the Buddha himself taught, don't necessarily, after you hear me teach, you don't have to believe everything. In fact, you don't have to believe anything that somebody teaches. What you do is you hear it, and then you put it into practice, and you see for yourself if it's true or not. The first part is hearing it. The second part is putting it into practice and seeing if it's true. What you don't want to do is spend all the time either just playing what we call cafeteria-style Buddhism, which is taking a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and not trying out any of it, just saying, oh yeah, it all sounds really good, especially this part, you know, from Tibetan Buddhism, and that part from Zen, and this part from... It's a good idea to familiarize ourselves with every single school, from Hinduism, go to Quaker meetings, go to as many different spiritual groups as you can, find something that resonates, but then dive into it for a while, and really hear the teachings, and then really try them out. You don't have to, again... When you try it out, you don't have to believe everything you hear. You can. I personally find the bulk of what the Buddha taught in my experience when I practice it to cause release from suffering. But there are certain teachings that the Buddha taught that I haven't seen yet to be true. The Buddha taught about rebirth, and he said that in his meditation upon his enlightenment, he saw his previous lives, which is great. I've never seen any previous lives. I can remember when I was 12, which was not fun, believe me, but I have no idea about these previous lives. I haven't seen any of them. The Buddha's teachings on rebirth are actually notoriously vague. He actually didn't actually say, oh great, what is reborn? He said, well, what's not reborn is consciousness, our thoughts, our feelings, our body sensations, or our perceptions. So what is reborn? I leave that up to you. I don't know. But some people who use the analogy of the famous analogy of one candle passing its flame to another candle, and you know what is really passed along there is sort of the energy. So that's it. But I still haven't even seen that energy in terms of previous lives. I've just seen that energy of craving in my own life in this lifetime. So I can attest to that There's some people who say, in fact, the only thing you really should believe after putting into practice that you really need to believe in if you want to take this spiritual path is the idea of karma, which is that skillful actions will give birth to a sense of peace in the long term, and that selfish, harmful actions in the long term will give birth to a lack of emotional, mental peace, stability, quietude. That's it. And really, I think that makes sense. Really, the idea is to listen, keep an open mind, and put the stuff into practice, and to try to let go of the preferences that we bring before we actually hear what's in all of the different spiritual paths around us, to listen, to put them into practice, to see what's true, and then sometimes, or quite often, we'll find that there's things that we brought that turned out to be not the case. Now, the third, and perhaps the most important, although they're all really important, of these seven tools, is to turn the spotlight on ourselves and to see where our minds have been of late. And to ask ourselves, have we had any tendencies that have been causing ourselves stress? To know one's how one's mind is causing itself suffering. I've been teaching here for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and there's been literally thousands of questions at the end of each talk, and by and large, the bulk of the questions go along the lines of, well, there's a real asshole in my life. Or there's somebody who's a real pain in the neck, or my sister is causing me agita, or my boss is impossible, or my friends are unskillful. I rarely get a question like, I'm a jerk, or I've been a mess of late, or I'm causing myself, sometimes people realize that they're causing themselves, but most of the time there's a tendency we all have, I don't mean to leave myself out of this at all, we all have a tendency when there's stress to first blame the world around us. It's the problem of my coworkers, roommates, my boyfriend or girlfriend or my mother or my dad's all to blame or whatever. And the idea is before we go to blaming anything outside of ourselves, to first turn the spotlight on and say, wait a second, is there anything here that I could change that would get rid of this suffering and stress that's going on? Now, that sounds like not a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to blame people around us, and it's not a lot of fun to say, well, what am I doing that's causing me discomfort? But actually, in the long term, it's a really, really, really good idea. Why? Well, if you blame the people around you for your stress and your suffering, there's only two things you can do. You can either suck it up, or you can dump them as friends or people in your lives. Very little else you can do. You really, if you're going to try to change them, good fucking luck. Really. I mean, how many people have you successfully changed to your own agenda and made them exactly the way you want them to be? My experience hasn't happened. But maybe you found the magic key. But if you decide, well, wait, the bulk of this is actually being caused by my expectations of the way I think everybody should behave. And maybe if I let go of these fundamental beliefs I have, maybe that would be an approach. If we instead say, well, actually the problem starts here with me, that's something that can be solved. I can actually have enormous amounts of input into my own actions, my own thoughts, my own where I focus the mind, what I think about. So if I decide, okay, I'm going to look, and the Buddha talks in this example about asking ourselves, has the mind been gravitating towards craving? Have we been really craving something in the world, or have we been really averse? Or, he says, is there something that's been pissing us off. He doesn't literally use the term piss off, but I like it. He says there's something that's really irritating us. And if so, especially if more than one person's doing it, chances are it's in me, not in them. If there's one person who's really really pissing me off, there might be a possibility that there's something a little bit fucked up with them. But if a lot of people are making me feel left out, or like I'm not successful, or that I'm not, you know, accomplishing enough, or I'm not the star of the social scene or whatever, then the chances are there's something in me that's projecting onto other people. So really ask ourselves, before we blame the world, the people around us, what is it that I can change? What is it that I'm expecting? What is it that I'm, what beliefs am I putting on in terms of the way I believe people should behave that I'm bringing to this? Now, the fourth is a sense of having moderation in the way we practice, which means not going off, or a sense of balance, I should say. The Buddha talked about there's four requisites. We need to have food, shelter, clothes, and we need to occasionally have medicine. And so the idea in life is to strike a balance. I'm personally lucky that my issues in life have been largely with drugs and alcohol, which are easy enough to deal with because I just don't take them. Now, God forbid I'd have the food issues, because that requires real balance, right? You have to eat unless you're somebody really special. And that requires balance. But we really all have those issues to face. We all have to balance how much happiness we're seeking from things, from clothes, from food, from, you know, the stuff that we acquire. How much effort do we put into that, as opposed to how much effort do we put into our spiritual practice? And then in our spiritual practice, letting go of the things that we always go to a bit, letting go a little bit, and focusing on the parts of our practice that we don't generally gravitate towards. For example, as I said at the beginning, there's a tendency for some of us to be really, really good at the meditation part. I really, really like to meditate. But there's some people who are much better at putting real work into the precepts, or putting real work into the studying part, the wisdom part, or putting real work into metta practice, generosity, gratitude, a sense of, if we're anger, putting it to forgiveness. There's all these ways of balancing. The Buddha said if we're... we find ourselves in craving, we can practice gratitude. So again, there's all these ways to rebalance the mind, but if we're stuck just doing one thing, one or a few kinds of spiritual practice, we're not sharpening all of our tools in our spiritual tool chest, and then when we really need something to be there, it won't be ready. It's a little bit like... in life, we can suddenly be faced with a crisis. We can be faced with a sense of people have midlife crises where they wonder what's it all about. And if you haven't been practicing or prepared to practice generosity in one's time, putting effort into volunteering and stuff like that, it'll be very hard to find a sense of purpose. So we want to have these things ready. On the other hand, we might be over-attached to finding our sense of self-worth by getting approval from other people. And we might be very easily thrown by criticism. In which case, we have to have balanced that out by a sense of appreciation, mudita, a sense of appreciating the skillful things we've done. So we have to practice all of these tools to have them ready for when something really fucked up happens, or when we're really facing a difficult situation. Now, the last three, and they're sort of fun, the last three. The the fifth is having a sense of kalatana, which is the Pali word for a sense of the time and the place. The basic idea is that if it's, for example, really loud outside, I once gave led a meditation while there was a marching band literally outside here. And for a minute or two, I tried to keep people on the breath, and then I realized this is fucked up, right? There's a marching band out there. There's no way these people are going to stay with the breath. So instead, I changed the meditation to, let's work with how we relate to this marching band. Like, if you really like it, examine how the body reacts to it. If you really don't like it, which I really didn't, just focus on how the body reacts to it, the mind reacts, and see if we can relax the body and the mind. So again, having a sense of what's really going on, not bringing our preferences to what we should be practicing. A lot of times people say, for example, it would be great if we could have a walking meditation here on Tuesday nights. Unfortunately, there's generally 60 or 70 people. There's not enough room right now to do a walking meditation. So we have to do the sitting meditation, but that doesn't mean that at other times, when there's a suitable situation in life, for example, when you want to get some peace on the way to work, that's the perfect time in the subway to practice standing meditation or walking meditation. So having a sense of where you are, what's going on, and what's appropriate is kalatana. It means not forcing our spiritual practice against what's going on in the world. It's seeing what's going on, seeing when there's, for example, a lot of distractions, and then deciding, okay, there's a lot of distractions. I'm just going to work on finding an easy, comfortable breath while I also pay attention to my job. The last two are about the people in our lives, who we're with. And it's number six is having a sense of what kind of society you live in and what kind of people you're hanging out with. And knowing when it's appropriate to talk and what kinds of things you should say and when it's appropriate to keep silent. This not only means, for example, just, you know, when I was in a younger part of my spiritual practice, and some people will accuse me of that never having ended, could be very proselytizing about, you know, how great Buddhism was. You know, you get very excited. But then eventually you get older, you get a beard, you know, whatever. Get a lot of tattoos, grizzly voice, and none of this has to do with anything. But you realize that there's times where it's just not appropriate, where you just really want to balance the spiritual part of your lives with also the parts of your life where you can just enjoy yourself. You know, I mean, I remember a great story that my co-teacher Craig told me. He was on retreat with the great Ajahn Chef, and they were going to go in the desert for a week. And Craig, being the virtuous, wonderful practitioner he is, brought nothing but Buddhist books to read in the desert. And his teacher, the guy who wrote the Buddhist books, Ajahn Chef, said, "What are you doing? You're going to be in the desert for a week and you're only going to read books by me? You're going to lose your mind." And Craig said, no, this is a spiritual journey. And he said by day two, he was losing his fucking mind. And I study this every day, but I would not have 25 years of reading Buddhism and 10 years of daily Pali Canon unless, believe me, I watched a good BBC mystery practically five times a week. I just will go on and just watch an hour and a half British television mystery, where hopefully there'll be a bloody body with a serial killer and lots of darkness and a complex detective who'll speak in a very dense British accent. And I don't know why, but that just balances out my spiritual practice. And you need to have both. You need to have a sense of, on the one hand, yes, I'm going to put my energy into familiarizing myself with the Dhamma, practicing it, focusing the spotlight on what I've been doing to cause suffering, noticing the kinds of, the place and the time are indicating, but there's also a sense of balancing it out with having some, a space from it. And having a sense of the people you're around and when it's appropriate to be Mr. or Mrs. Buddha or Ms. Buddha and when it's appropriate to be, just another fucking person relaxing and chatting with some friends. They might not all the time want to hear about how the Dhamma is affecting my life. So we all have to, it's something to bear in mind and to really, so again, it really plays into the sense of place and time, a sense of the people that we're around. Finally, the sixth is the one that I think causes a lot of questioning in the past, which is having a sense of the people that we surround ourselves with and knowing which ones are the ones that we're going to use as examples and which ones are just there for, fun, but we are not going to use as examples for our spiritual practice. What this means is a lot of people bring to Buddhism this sense that the Buddha taught, well, you don't judge people. And in a sense, that's true, because the Buddha said that you don't judge people's identities, but you do judge behavior. And you do know when somebody is behaving in a way consistently that is not skillful or not spiritually appropriate, and you then say, okay, this person, they're in my life, they're in my family, they're a friend, they're somebody I've known for years, but they're not somebody I want to bring my confusion or my problems or my questioning or my need for emotional mirroring to. A lot of people really, 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 really want that to be their parents, right? We really want our mothers or our fathers or our sisters or our brothers to be there and emotionally supportive and open and wise. And then you get to a point in your life often where it's like, holy shit, I've never gotten that from those people. And there can be this great sense of, I'm fucked, but you're not. Because guess what? You're surrounded here by people who are attempting a spiritual path. You don't need the emotional mirroring to come from the people you want it to come from. It just has to be available. So you have to let go, again, of the preferences of, I really want, my best friend that I've had since high school to be the one who will always be available and sympathetic. They might not be. They might have suddenly a child or a new husband or wife, and they might not be the person who's going to give you the support you want. But that doesn't mean you give up. It means you look around and you find somebody wise who can give you what you want. The Buddha said the things to bear in mind are find somebody who's tolerant, i.e. they can put up with a little bit of, over the years, we all give our friends grief at times. They should be somebody who can share important things without going around and blabbing, unless they're things that you really want to share with the world. So they should be trustworthy. They should be somebody who's wise and somebody who's been there in times of need. So somebody who's consistent. Just look for these types of people. Keep an eye out. Know what's available to you so that even if the person that you go to first or second or third is not there to give you the support you need, that you keep trying until you find somebody who is. As they say, you don't go to the hardware store for orange juice, you go to the deli for it. So stop going to the hardware store. So those are the seven things to bear in mind and to bring some balance into our spiritual lives. And the basic gist of them all is to see what we can do to let go of always going where our preferences lead us, and instead open our eyes and see really where the truth of suffering and release from suffering is in our lives. So that's a nice talk, and now it's your turn to ask any questions about anything or share anything that comes to mind that is going on. So thanks for listening. Hi.
When you were talking about blaming other people,
you know, in Buddhism there are all these teachings about and like all that's true, but it made me think about like this all from the perspective of like what's gonna be like the best thing for you, like awesome. In my line of work, I once met this dude, and he was like, didn't really like a sociopath. He didn't have like social emotions, he didn't have empathy, he didn't have any respect for other people. He wasn't like evil or mean, just in the hair. And I thought to myself, like, you know, I should hang around this guy, because like, I should try to keep him on the people, these people like that really fuck up other people's lives, especially. Situation where you have to sort of associate, you know. But in doing that, I was like, you know, the more I talk to him, like, the more fucking weird this is for me, because what goes on in his head is like the opposite of skill. And just to try to like wrap my mind around like how this guy works, is bad for me. So like there's this like mismatch between like what's skillful for me for my own good and what's skillful for other people, like, because I like to think that like trying to hang with them and like keep away from like others is sort of good for them. So I don't know, I'm just curious about like the difference between the balancing that's good for you and good for other people making choices about them.
I don't think that there would be, though, a pure opposition between or a sense of divide between what's good for you and what's good for other people, and that the Buddha never said in the Pali Canon there's this idea of sacrificing one's own happiness for the benefit of others. That's very much in the teachings of the Bodhisattva path, more so than it is in the Buddha's actual teachings, which are always that your skillful action should never come at the extent or the sacrificing your own personal lasting peace of mind. He says that many times throughout. Now, sociopaths are interesting because they're the one group of people that karma doesn't apply to. Because if you don't have mirror genes, if you do not feel any remorse at unskillful actions or any sense of long-term distaste or any sense of discomfort when you've acted horribly to another human being, well, then karma doesn't apply to you. And I personally, now this is just me, this is not you, and you have to determine your own practice, but I would not personally want to be around a true sociopath. Because I would not want to be around somebody whose actions, no matter how unskillful, did not affect them adversely. I want to be around people who have the opportunity to see the long-term results of their actions and grow from them. Now, luckily, true sociopaths, which would be somebody who's got a noticeable depletion of mirror genes, are really, really rare. The last I read that they're 0.1, they're 0.1% of the population. So by and large, you're not going to run into them very often. And if you ran into one who was socialized, who was not, you know, a career criminal, you're very lucky, because most of them are, you know, lead generally very often unskillful lives. So I can't really say from my own practice that there's a value Now, in terms of the larger question, is there something of value of putting aside, going where it's skillful, where it's more beneficial for you, like hanging out with people that are better examples, as opposed to hanging out with people that you could bring some kind of wisdom? I think that that's where balance comes in, right? I think that you want to balance being around people who are great spiritual examples, but at the same time, you don't want to have it be nothing. Unless you're, if you're a renunciate, you're a monk, and you're living in a monastery and retreat, you'll probably be around a lot of only skillful people. But most of us who are lay practitioners, it's a matter of balance. And most of us are going to be overbalanced towards surrounding ourselves with a lot of people who are not living any kind of spiritual life. Because most people in the world today aren't. It's just a fact. So if it's about achieving balance. And I think in most cases, it's about putting a little bit more effort into surrounding ourselves with wise spiritual practitioners, because we are very influential. We are easy to influence. Even the most profoundly wise person, if they surround themselves with people who gravitate towards, sensual pleasure and acquiring and anger and all that stuff, we're going to drift in that direction. So it's about achieving balance. I hope that...
Yeah, I think that's what I was looking for. Or rather, it's the kind of answer that answers my question.
Oh, good.
It's something I'm thinking about.
Yes. And the thing about balance is that you're never there. Balance is always a continuing thing. That's why the spiritual practice is... always going on. We always have to, even after people achieve enlightenment, there's more work. Because there's always, the mind always will gravitate a little bit left or a little bit right, a little bit towards wanting to do this or a little bit towards wanting to do that, and we constantly have to readjust. So as lay practitioners, it's about balancing our careers or our work with our spiritual practice, our relationship with our spiritual practice, being around skillful people as opposed to sometimes just being around whoever we have to be around according to our jobs, etc. So it's bringing a sense of reflecting and balance to all these practices. Thank you. Oh, hey.
Hi. Thanks for the teaching. A somewhat technical question about meditation. Early on, when I started with meditation, I was taught to put my attention on the breath, notice when it goes off, bring it back. Later on, I was taught that, in fact, the Buddha taught Anapanasati breath meditation is 16 steps. That's the first one.
Right.
That the second step is to evaluate the breath and see whether there's ease in it.
Mm.
And the third step is to have that ease when you generate it to spread. And in fact, when you guide the meditation, I hear you saying with the exhalation, I'm paraphrasing you with the exhalation, allow the ease to spread, try to get the inhalation to feel easeful. I do believe that a couple of weeks ago when we were with those nuns from California, that I believe her name was Ajahn Santachitta, was saying the first step is good enough. So was that sort of what she was saying? And that's one thing. And also, what are your thoughts about that? Because frequently I've been with teachers who never mention anything about the first step.
Well, actually, when she said that, we were talking about mindfulness. Which he said, mindfulness, when we were talking, was... And the Buddha said mindfulness is always appropriate. But when I was talking with her, I was saying, well, there's all these other practices and the seven factors of enlightenment that she wasn't really discussing. She said, well, for her practice, mindfulness was enough. And it wasn't really about the Anapanasati. It was more about mindfulness. The first step of the Anapanasati would never be enough, because that would just be mindfulness of the in-breath. You need the second step, which would be mindfulness of the out-breath. So you need two. And then the third is seeing which breath is relaxing and not, which is not, and then spreading it, the fourth. And then there's 16 in total, and then the next is going to feelings, relaxing the feelings, and the third is relaxing the mind. And then achieving a sense of equanimity and balance in the later ones of the Anapanasati. And I think that every monk and nun would agree that all the steps of the Anapanasati are valuable. They're not really about mindfulness. Anapanasati is, if it is, it's the entire 16 are about mindfulness of the breath. So they're all valuable. And she was saying more that things like analysis of skillful versus unskillful thoughts was something that she didn't really work with that much. In terms of, she just practiced being aware of them, but she didn't bother to do the other practices of judging whether they're skillful or unskillful, and then using the five ways of getting rid of unskillful thoughts. She said that was not part of her practice. That I found interesting, in that I really have always been, with monks that have taught that you should use as much of the teachings as possible, not just mindfulness, but all the difference. But if she's achieved lasting peace just through mindfulness, that's terrific. It would be indicative of the school that she's from, the Sumedho school, which is very known for Sati Sampajana. So they generally tend to focus on mindfulness, and they tend to be really, 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 really adept practitioners in that, just watching stuff until it goes away. Don't take any preemptive strikes. Don't replace thoughts. Don't, relax the body to get rid of them. Don't, reflect on how they're unskillful. Just watch them until they go away. And that's that school.
Which is much more passive.
Much more passive.
And isn't that analogous to the style of meditation where you just watch the breath and come back, watch the breath and come back, rather than take some initiative, some mental initiative, to generate it being easeful and to generate it spreading?
I would say that they would do that more than they would do the judging of thoughts. There's nothing wrong with cultivating, I would think from their perspective, cultivating an easeful breath and spreading it. I don't think they would consider that to be interventionist, but they do consider a lot of the practices that Ajahn Jeff and Lee and Ajahn Phuan and some of the other Thai forest monks talk about outside of the Sumedho school. They do believe that they're much more analytical and thought-based, and they don't like them as much. And that's very, very indicative of the Sumedho school of Buddhism. They're perfectly wonderful, wonderful monks, and they're very good at what they do. So it just depends on what works for you.
Thanks.
So let's close with a very brief meditation.
Very nice working.
Great. Thank you very, very much.
I had the same problem today. Somebody show me.